Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Dave LeBlanc, 34 years of volunteer and career experience, Chief of Department with Harwich Fire Department in Massachusetts. I was very fortunate to attend one of Dave's lectures a few months back and was even invited to eat dinner with the man where I got to see him up close and personal. Dave is a chief that cares first and foremost about the citizens we serve, the mission, and the men and women of the organization. Be sure to catch the gems and nuggets being dropped along the way as you hear his viewpoints on various topics. With that, I present Mr. Dave LeBlanc.
So my name is Dave LeBlanc. And so my journey started probably like most kids. You know, I was growing up in upstate New York with a volunteer department, and you know, remember the fire trucks coming to school, and that kind of started my interest. But when I moved to Massachusetts, I grew up 2 miles down the street from a firefighter in Dennis, and started to become interested in the fire department. Read a report from Engine Company 82, got really interested in it, and then I started taking pictures, and he would, whenever there was a, because they had recall from home for fires or whatever, so whenever there was a fire, he told me, he's like, just come up the street, if I'm gone, you can get in the truck and go with me. So I started going to fires, you know, 14, 15 years old, with him, and that just progressed into my love for the fire service and what I wanted to do, and took the picture thing. I used to chase fires all the time. You know, when I was in Connecticut, I lived outside of Boston for a while and did that. So I really, you know, just have always kind of loved everything about every aspect about it. I'm a buff, you know, to put it bluntly. But yeah, it was kind of how I got started. You know, if it wasn't for a couple of people kind of steering me down the path and start, you know, fostering that interest, I don't know that I would have ended up in the same place. But I went to high school and knew that I was going to go to college for a degree in fire science and try and be a firefighter when I came out of college. So that was my plan. So it's kind of nice to have a focus early on. You know, I didn't kind of wander like a lot of people do. So.
Okay. All right. Love it. Love it. So for those that don't know, including myself, can you please explain the size of Harwich, amount of personnel, how many stations, things of that nature?
Sure. So Harwich is, for those that aren't familiar, unless you've met Jess Rebzinka and you know the mapping, the arm mapping that he does, but Harwich is a peninsula of the six south of the eastern coast of Massachusetts. Cape Cod is a peninsula. Harwich is almost to the elbow. If you were looking at the arm, and it's 20 square miles, just almost 21 square miles. By definition, we're a rural community. We have a year-round population of about 15,000, 16,000. But summertime, that population probably is closer to 40 or 45,000. It almost triples. A lot of seasonal homes, a lot of Airbnb homes now, that whole demographic change in the community. So it's really interesting. I've had rental properties, but rental properties are much more pervasive to the whole town, where they used to just kind of be concentrated on the shoreline and closer to the water. Now they're, you know, my neighborhood is not near the water at all, and there's half a dozen Airbnbs in my neighborhood now. So very transient population in the summertime, and then a very dormant population, you know, come the wintertime. We run two stations. All career, we used to have a call fire department. We had to, didn't have to. We eliminated it. The department eliminated it back in the late 80s. There was some questions with insurance coverage and retirement coverage, more importantly, for firefighters that were call firefighters. So if they got injured or something happened in the line of duty, so they ended up phasing out the call department, went to 100% career staff. And at that time, there were six full-time firefighters. This would be about 88, 87, 88, six full-time firefighters on duty and one dispatcher. We had civilian dispatchers. That model existed up until, so from 88 to almost 2000. 2000, we hired one medic per shift. We went to seven per shift and still had the dispatchers. And then we've recently, you know, we just trying to move the ball forward. We had layoffs in 05, which was kind of ugly. Because we're a really short staff department, and it took us down 11 people we were able to get them back, most of them back. So we kind of overcome that. But in the process, delayed probably there would have been the natural growth of our manpower and our staffing. So we just recently were running a 9-person shift now, 8-person minimum starting July 1st, which gives us 3 at the outstation, 5 at headquarters. We man the ambulance with 3 all the time. Ambulance transport times for us are about 20 minutes. So when ambulance call total is probably close to 2 hours from the time it comes in to the time the truck is back in service. So we added that 8th person so that there's always at least 2 people at headquarters to staff the engine. The shift officer, the captain, stays back, and now we have a driver. And so at least we're minimally staffing that engine. We do recall people. They do come back off duty, but that can get hard to fill, especially when we're putting 4 ambulances on the road, which is pretty routine in the summertime. So it's just, it's kind of what works for us. It's not a perfect system, but we also, you balance it with what the needs of the town are and what the financial ability of the town is to maintain that level of staffing. And we've been fortunate that we made over the last 2 or 3 years an argument to increase that staffing, and the town's been supportive of that. And, I guess the lesson, one of the lessons I would say to everybody that kind of came out of that for me since I started is, well, since my whole career, but especially once I made deputy chief, is, every interaction counts with the public. They support you, but, one bad interaction can, probably has a tenfold impact on your organizations versus 100 good ones. We used a lot of political capital. We got a lot of support for the good work that's been done over time in the department. And that was why we were successful and able to get this manpower increase and get our staffing up. But not to go too far afield, but it's definitely a lesson that I've learned is, there's always those days where you don't feel like helping somebody out, or it seems like a stupid call or whatever. And, we always talk about, people never call 911 for stupid reasons. For them, it's the most important thing in their life, even if it seems dumb to you. And it's really important that you treat all those calls as, they're not as important as the next call, but you need to treat them as important as they are to that person, I guess. So out of those 2 stations, we staff, as I said, 4 ambulances. So the, the duty crew will staff the primary 2 trucks, and then recall personnel, off-duty personnel will staff the other trucks as needed. We have 2 engines at the outstation. We have an engine in the truck at the headquarters station, and we're in the process of building a mini pumper, so that when the headquarters engine is out, the truck's a Quint. We run it as a dedicated truck company, but it has a pump and tank and hose on it, so we can use it as when the primary engine goes out of service, we can use it as both. The idea with a mini pumper is the routine calls that you wouldn't necessarily want to send the ladder truck down the road for, motor vehicle accidents, local alarms, CO detectors, those kind of things. The mini pumper will be able to handle those and take the wear and tear off the ladder truck. So that's kind of the plan as we're going forward. We do have another pump on order, which will put us back to 4 full pumps, but that's 4 years out. It's not on order. It's in the plan. If it gets approved, it'll be 4 years out from next year. So
yeah,
the vehicle replacement market right now is insane. We're ordering an ambulance right now. It's going to take 3 years to build. We replace them every 2 years. It's going to take us 3 years to get it. It's insane.
Wow. Okay. I did not know that with ambulances as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I found that out the hard way when we got ready to order this truck, that they're like, yeah, no, the company just delivered number 5,400, and if we ordered that day, it was going to be number 6,000. And they build 200 a year, and they're not a small company. It's not a small company, so it's just some of the nuances of dealing with stuff. Nothing's as easy as it used to be. The pumper that we're going to order next year isn't slated to be replaced till 2032, but we moved it up because it's going to take, with estimates, are 3 to 4 years to build it.
Right.
So. Trying to navigate that and keep the fleet running is definitely a challenge.
Definitely. Okay. All right. So are all your personnel ALS or BLS?
We have a mixture. I think I don't want to say 50-50. We're probably, I'd have to look at the exact numbers, but I think we're 21 medics out of 40. two of the medics are captains, so they don't necessarily operate like when they're on shift. We don't staff them as a medic. So if we have a requirement, there has to be a medic in each station at the beginning of the shift. The captain won't count as the medic because their job is different. You know, their job is to manage the shift, to manage the town, and we don't want them being committed to going out in that ambulance. But they may end up getting stuck going on like a second or a third ambulance call if we can't get a medic. It just depends on how that all works out. But yeah, so we're about 50-50. We're trying. It's hard right now. The hiring pool is so much different than, you know, when I started. And even from 5 years ago, we would get 100 applications for one job. And now we're getting maybe 20 or 30 for, we had four positions open last July. We hired four people last July. The plan was to hire two medics and two EMTs. We ended up hiring, we hired one medic and three EMTs. Because that's what the pool gave us. And it was out of the four positions, we had 40 applications, and of the 40, less than half met what our minimum requirements are.
Mm-hmm.
So, we got really lucky that we hired people that had worked in other departments. So the way the thing used to be done, there used to be a local fire academy that ran a firefighter 1-2 program. So a lot of, we had more call departments than we do now. Almost all the call departments are gone on the Cape. Provincetown still runs a volunteer department, and West Barnstable still runs a call department. And some other departments have a call force. They use it more to train people up and, you know, to kind of give them a path in. But we had this local fire academy, and everybody could get firefighter 1-2 certified. So we were able to hire, we had a lot bigger pool of candidates that we could put to work right away when they got hired. What happens now is if we hire somebody with no firefighter training, which is becoming more and more the case, we run them through basically firefighter 1-2 in 2 weeks or 3 weeks in-house. So at least they've had the training and the skills. So we don't have enough depth for them to just ride the ambulance and not be on the fire truck.
Mm-hmm.
So we put them in that position, and then anybody that gets hired in our town goes to the state academy. Massachusetts has the Mass Fire Academy does a recruit training program. The bigger cities, Boston, Brockton, will do their own, but the state runs one for all the departments statewide that you can send somebody to. So all of our personnel, when they get hired, unless they have I've already been or have more than 3 years experience, have to go to the state academy. So we just train them enough to tide them over till we can get them to the state academy, which sometimes can take up to 6 or 8 months. So that's a long time to have them on the shift with not being able to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, being able to do the minimum. So it's not perfect. You know, we're trying to work through it, make it better, but it's a struggle.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Everything nowadays seems like is a struggle. And I'm assuming if you have a first due structural box that comes in, you're getting both Harwich departments, and I'm assuming you have mutual aid coming in as well.
Yeah. So when the call department got eliminated in 88, Harwich started, we always kind of had little small line box agreements or automatic aid agreements for certain parts of town. So like Dennis used to come in. Dennis is on the west side of Harwich. They would come into West Harwich, just not even the whole district, just half the district. When they did away with the call department, they made some other changes. And one of the things they did was they increased this line response agreement. So they basically split the town in half, and they would get one company from either Dennis, Chatham, or Brewster, which are our three surrounding towns. That's evolved over the years to the point now where our structural assignment for a reported fire is, if everybody's in quarters, is two engines in a truck from Harwich, and then two more engines and a truck on the line response. So all three communities respond. It works really well. We work really well together, and all three of those communities mirror that model. So we go to them just as equally as they come to us. Chatham, actually, because we surround Chatham on two sides, and Chatham is the elbow. So again, you're looking at the Cape, that's Chatham, and Harwich is on both sides of it. We actually send an engine and a truck to any reported fire in Chatham right out of the door. So we're sending our entire, basically our entire on-duty shift. And our chief officers are part of that response. So anytime our companies go out of town to go to work, one of the either myself or the deputy will go as part of the assignment. And we work really well with all the surrounding towns. So that's worked out. We, you know, they come to us, they go to work. We know we can put them, we know we can trust them. And that works out really well for everybody involved. And guarantees, doesn't guarantee, but it increases the likelihood that we're going to put at least, you know, 10 or 12 people on the fire ground right away. You know, we, any box or structural assignment in Harwich, all off-duty personnel are recalled. That response factor changes. You know, it could be as quick as 5 minutes, or it could be as long as 10 minutes. It could be longer, depending on where they are, what the traffic is, and everything else. So at least with the automatic aid, we're trying to get those mutual aid resources quickly. But EMS calls, the bane of everybody's existence, will change what everybody's staffing is around us. And they're not always available based on, you know, what they have going on in that day. So
okay.
It's a balance, you know, it's a balance. And we recently adopted, so we used to, the mutual aid system on the Cape, it's been a great system. It's been in existence for a long time. And it's really robust. But when everybody had call departments and career staffing, like an individual community used to be able to staff like two or three pieces for a fire. So a fire in Provincetown, you know, say second or third alarm in Provincetown, which is from my house where I'm sitting right now, 40 minutes, 30 minutes, 35 minutes, lights and siren. It's all the way. It's a long way.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, that assignment, you know, second alarm wouldn't get past East Ham, which is like, if you look at the Cape, they're all single towns as you come down the peninsula. So Provincetown's the tip, then Trail, then Wellfleet, then East Ham. So like a second alarm, you know, Harwich may move to cover like Orleans or something like that, but there wasn't big movement. We adopted the Metro Fire style running assignment for Boston. So Metro Fire District 13 around Boston, each community has an availability. Basically, it's, you know, one engine, one truck, or one engine or one truck. It depends on what it is. And that's what they send. And then they don't send anything else. Essentially, they provide their own coverage. They send a resource, and then the next resource comes from farther away.
Okay.
So the Cape, we just finished converting basically everybody's running assignments over to that system. So now when I look at Harwich, my second alarm companies are coming from Hyannis and Wellfleet or East Ham, which is 20 minutes. So if we don't hit it heavy in that initial response,
mm-hmm.
and we have to go to a second alarm, we're going to wait, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes potentially to get those resources in. And that's just what's evolved over time based on what everybody can actually put on the road for apparatus. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, we have to change as the situation changes. So it's just, everything's a little bit different than it used to be.
Okay. No, and I totally understand. I mean, the days of volunteerism is down. The days of where people can leave their full-time job to answer calls, that has, I'm sure, dwindled significantly. So, I mean,
and even our personnel, you know, our guys really come back. They're good at staffing the station when we get busy. But it's, you know, everybody, it's changed. We're so much busier now than we ever used to be on shift. That, you know, and people have families and lives and their wives work and everything else. So, people aren't available. We just celebrated yesterday. We just pinned a guy 40 years on the job. He's like one of my captains. Great guy. He's old school. He grew up in the town I grew up in. Started before me, probably about 10 years before me in Harwich. But he's one of those guys that he comes back. It's not about overtime. It's not about making the paycheck. It's about the commitment to the department, to the community. You know, that old school volunteerism mindset. And I'm not saying that the new guys don't have that. I'm just saying that family dynamics, that life, that everything else has changed. And that has to take a balance with everything else that people have going on. Where he's literally a drop everything. He could be in the middle of doing one of his other seven side jobs that he has, and he'll literally drop everything and come in. that's not always the case with everybody else. And it doesn't reflect poorly on the new people. It's just a change in kind of mindset and mentality that the administration and the fire department have had to kind of overcome, which is why we've been pushing to kind of increase our shift staffing. So we can at least guarantee that we have enough people on duty to meet a minimum number of calls, effectively without having to rely as much on people coming in off duty.
Right. Okay. All right. Totally understood. Totally understood. I'm gonna go to a first official question for you, and that is, with you being the fire chief, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
I love and hate the word aggressive. I really do. And I think that some of that comes from the social media world that we live in now, where where it's used as a bad mindset, right? I grew up in the internet like everybody else, as this has progressed. And a long time ago when I started writing articles, and Bill Carey was kind enough to give me a place to share my thoughts. I would write articles, and comments would come out, "Oh, you're a cowboy," and everything else. And default aggressive to me, like, it means that you're squared away, you're prepared to do what you need to do, and you've accepted the mission for what it is. And aggressive is not reckless. Aggressive is not uneducated. Aggressive is not any of those things. Aggressive is knowing what your mission is, what your job is, accepting all aspects of that, which is risk and thoughtful, tactical response to that risk, and then doing the job. I feel like, and I just commented on something this morning. I feel like, where the fire service is kind of turned the metric on its ear about safety, where we talk about safety like it's this thing over here that we can talk about, way out in the distance without talking about everything else. And our safety comes from, somebody else wrote it much better than I can, but our safety comes from competence. We are safer when we're competent, when we're trained, when we do our job, when we, and that's safety, right? Safety is not, or aggression is not the opposite of safety at all. They should go hand in hand. You should be able to be safely aggressive or aggressively safe, however you want to word that. So this is where I get kind of balled up when I and I rant and bark at the moon like everybody else, but about, like, we have all these labels about things. And I don't know half the time when people argue about them that they know what they're arguing about. I know the environment that I operate in. I know what my people are capable of. I know what my resources are coming in, and I know what I'm going to be able to do as a department, what we're going to be able to do as a department in any given scenario. That changes for us literally on a call-by-call basis, because right now, the second ambulance just went out. So both stations are out right now. If I get a building fire right now, my aggressiveness, my response, my capabilities, my department's capabilities are going to be 50% different than they would have been 15 minutes ago when both ambulances were in quarters. And I think that people get hung up in the argument about aggressive and safety, because the equation is somebody from a busy engine company in, say, and I'm just going to throw them out, not that I'm picking on them, but New York City, and somebody that's on the most aggressive engine company in a small town USA, whatever it is, pick my town, right? There's no direct comparison between those two, other than they share the title fire department. There's no direct comparison there at all. And we lose people. I talked about this a little bit in North Carolina, like, what's the context of what we're talking about? My experience is not your experience, is not somebody else's experience. So I know what I know, but I don't know what you know, and I don't know what you're comfortable working in. So to me, aggressive is like being aware of what your capabilities are and then executing them to the fullest in the moment. And that's being aggressive. And some days that may be pulling the line and protecting the exposures, because that's all you can do, because there's two of you on the engine and your next company is 5, 7, 8, 10 minutes away. Conversely, that same fire 20 minutes later, and you're showing up with the eight people that are on duty, your line response companies are in there quickly, and you have 15 people on scene in 3 minutes. You're going to go through the front door, and you're going to put the fire out without having to worry about anything else, because you have that capability. So aggressive is being intelligent as to what your capabilities are and then executing them to the fullest, to me.
Okay. No, I like it. I totally understand it. So it's your viewpoint. So perfect. I don't get very many chief officers on here. So when I do, I also ask this question: what are your standards for the personnel that work for Harwich?
So, I'm going to start by a little bit of a segue into saying that anybody, I said this to the other day, one of the retired chiefs, we were talking, and I said, in my mind, anybody that goes into the fire academy should be given two books, hypothetically. Your strategy and tactics book for how your department's going to operate, and a foundation of leadership books, because the biggest mistake that I made in my career, as I look at back at it now, with 30 years and sitting here as the chief of department, is that I focused way too little on the leadership people aspect of operating a fire department. Never really expected that I was going to be here. Little segue in my story. When I first started on Harwich, I started out as a fire alarm operator, dispatcher. I did that for 7 years. I had a medical condition. I had surgery when I was 29 that fixed the problem, so to speak. I was able to get medically cleared, and we had a vacancy. I went to my chief at the time, who was a great guy, Bob Peterson, Poopsie, as we called him, not always to his face, but Pete was a great guy, and I pitched to him, and I was able to go from dispatch to being a firefighter. And there's a little bit of a story in there about if you want something bad enough, you'll do whatever it takes to get it done. And that's definitely a case. And everything in life, if it was meant to be, it was meant to be. In my case, it was. But when that happened, I had achieved, like, I was good. I was a firefighter. It's all I ever wanted to do. If I never made rank, if I never was a lieutenant, never a captain, I was fine. I didn't care. Well, time goes on. I studied for lieutenant. I made lieutenant on my first test. I was able to make captain on my captain's exam after that, and then figured that's where I was going to die. I had a younger deputy chief. My chief was ended up serving 11 years as chief. Had no intention of being able to promote up from that point forward. My deputy left to go to another department, and I got tapped to be the deputy at that point, and that kind of set the motion. But then all of a sudden, I found myself in the deputy's position going, man, I really wish I knew more about, I had spent more time on, like, trying to figure people out. I'm trying to figure out not necessarily management styles in the sense of management, but like who I wanted to be, how I want to run this organization. And we were blessed. My town, my department is blessed that it's had a culture, a very strong culture of doing the right thing forever. And they, this was born out of, I look back and try and figure out how we ended up this way. I think some of it's a holdover from the roots of our department, being a call organization and everything else. But I think some of it's born out of, we had a out of town, out of not an internal hire. We had a chief that they took from outside,
Okay.
and he was very divisive. This was like in the early 80s, very divisive. Ultimately ended up leaving town on a rail, was not, was essentially fired. And but that, conflict creates, can make the organization bond together, and it did. And I think that some of that culture that we have where we hold people accountable and everything else. So my standards are pretty much what my department standards are, and I want to say that I may not always be clear enough, and this is where I go back to, I wish I had paid attention more about setting my expectations, because partly because I don't have to, partly because my expectations are what the department's doing right now. So I've been very fortunate in that respect. What I would tell you, if I was going into a department that I'd never been in before, I would very clearly set my expectations out. My expectations are, you come to work ready to work, you understand what the job is. And you've trained and prepared yourself for that, what that is. And it's different every single day. And again, I talked about they're not necessarily the same importance, but to me, the woman that calls and says, my smoke detector's beeping, can you come help me? Or, we had a call recently that Father was in a fire department call at all. So a woman called and said there were two bunnies, stray bunnies in her window well in her house, didn't know what to do with them, called the police, the animal control officer. It was after hours, wasn't working. So what does everybody do? They call the fire department. Literally is what the woman wrote in her thank you letter to us. It's like, yeah, fire department, fix it. They fix everything. I had a captain on duty that was like, I had no idea what I'm going to do, but I'm going to go down there and do something. So they went down there. They brought a box with them. They had a little blanket. They put the bunnies in the blanket. And we have a place called Wild Care, which takes care of wild animals that get abandoned or whatever. The next day, the captain, when she left ship, brought the bunnies there. Like I said to you before, the political capital or the gain that you get from doing the right thing. And that's not why you do it. You don't do the right thing for that. You do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Ray Pfeiffer, God rest his soul, said that, you know, integrity is doing the right thing even when no one's watching. He said it all the time. But that culture is the culture that exists in my organization. So I haven't had to set that expectation. But that is an expectation that I have. Like, you do the right thing. You treat people the way you want to be treated, or more importantly, the way you want your family to be treated. And And that's an expectation. You know, no call is stupid. And my poopsie Pete, as we call them, used to always say, you know, we give service, not lip service. He would get violently angry if he heard somebody answer the phone and handle an incident, whatever it was, by just talking to somebody on the phone and hanging up. His feeling was if somebody took the time to call the department for a call, that we were going to go out to that call and we were going to handle that problem, whatever it was. So that culture is kind of the culture that exists. But again, if I had to set my standard is come to work prepared, come to work focused on the job, understand what the job is and make sure you're ready to do it, and then do the job.
Okay, very clear. Very clear expectations. Okay. In your opinion, should there be a years of service clause for promotion?
I would tell you yes, but well, not. So we certainly are hiring people that are way more capable than I was at the time when I was hired, both education-wise, not necessarily experience-wise, but knowledge, total knowledge-wise, so not just education, but I feel like experience ultimately is the greatest teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually had this conversation with a friend that recently got promoted. I'm like, you know, at some point you need to stop looking for the next rung on the ladder and enjoy the rung you're at, because you learn a lot at every step of the way. And I've learned both good and bad from every leader that I've had. We always take from our leaders the things that we think work for us, but I've also taken from my leaders things that I would never do, you know, as a boss. I think that's just as important. You know, that it's just as important that you understand the things that don't work or that made you feel like shit as an employee or as a subordinate that your boss did to you, and you go, I'm never going to do that to anybody. So I think that experience has to be a factor in promotions, which means years of service needs to be a factor in promotions. And I think that number is different. So seniority should never be the sole determining factor in whether somebody gets promoted. But if you have two equal candidates, one who's got 10 more years in grade than another one, depending on that candidate, they, in my mind, should be more qualified. Now, you could have that 10-year guy that's done nothing for 10 more years than the other person. Mm-hmm. So that's where it becomes a really gray, murky swamp of I don't know what the answer is to that. You know, it's you know, I hate to say it, it depends.
Right.
But it definitely needs to be a bar that's like, you need to have, in my mind, so many years on before you're eligible to promote, because you need to see at least that many years worth of calls, handle that many years worth of calls to be prepared for that next step of leading people. Because that's, you know, I think that gets lost a lot of times in the promotional conversation. And recently we had this conversation in-house, is that you're not just promoting to be in charge. There's certainly part of it, and everybody has different reasons for it. I was listening last night, somebody talking about, you know, some guys promoted because they wanted to they wanted their own bunk room. Some guys promoted because they didn't want to work for somebody else. Like, everybody has a different reason for what ultimately they promote for. I think that it's unrealistic to say that ego doesn't play into that in some place. Mm-hmm. It's as long as you know what your ego is, that's fine. You know, nobody has no ego. I try really hard to keep mine in check and realize that I'm not the smartest person in the room ever. And I know that I'm not the smartest person in the room, but when I'm talking with people and everything else, I try and make sure that I'm always saying, yo, okay, let's listen to what they have to say. Let's make sure that it balances out. But I think what gets lost sometimes in the promotion aspect is that you are responsible for other people's lives.
Right.
Both the citizens, which is, you know, our first mission to serve, but also the people on the truck that came with you. And that is a responsibility that you can't put a value to it. I think that gets lost, and some of the people want to promote for a variety of reasons and don't always consider that ramification or that piece of it. It's like, hey, when you're in charge, when you're the lieutenant of that engine company or the captain of that engine company or the chief or whatever, you're in charge of those people's lives. Every decision you make is going to impact their lives, potentially their family's lives. And that to me means, and I'm not saying it always was for me. I'm definitely looking at this hindsight now, where I'm looking at it from my lens of being the chief and saying, holy shit, I'm responsible for all these people. But that needs to be part of the equation when you promote. You need to look at that, is that I'm going to be responsible. Other people are going to rely on me to make good decisions and to not get them injured or killed. Because getting injured or killed could happen even if you make all the best decisions in the world. But if you make bad decisions, you increase the likelihood, you know. So.
No, definitely. 100% accurate. I'm with you on it. One of my pet peeves is if I ask somebody, why do you want to promote? If they say money, I'm sorry, you're out. If it was up to me, granted, some of these people still get promoted, but promoting for money, promoting for title, promoting because whenever I hear I don't want to work for somebody, I kind of get that, because there are some people, it's like, do you really want to take instructions from this person? So I give them leeway. But man, when you do it for title, money, or like crazy things such as I wanted my own like bedroom, I look at you in a different light, because to me, you should want to promote to make change, and change for the good, positive change. And I understand we all have to provide for our families, but to me, I don't know anybody that said I got into the fire service to make money, because we make okay money. You know what I'm saying? It's not like I didn't get in this business to be rich.
No, 100%. And so the only thing I would tell you is that I would say you promote to make the organization better versus change.
Okay.
Because not all change is better. And I'm not picking apart what you're saying, but in my mind, that's right. That's you promote, your bottom line reason should be that you feel like you have something to offer that's going to improve the organization. But I'm going to be 100% honest with you. All those other things that you mentioned, you know, salary, you know, pay, everything else, those are all factors. And if you're not honest with yourself,
right,
shouldn't be the only reason. But if you're not honest with yourself, I mean, Will Stapleton, I love reading his books, and he, you know, was a commissioner in Boston. And, you know, one of the things that he said, you know, really early on, one of the guys told him was like, well, I mean, I take a lieutenant's test or whatever. And he goes, well, I don't know. He goes, listen, he goes, you got to do this job for 30 years. You might as well make the most money you can while you're doing it. Doesn't mean that that money was the sole motivating factor for getting promoted. But if you're going to do the same job and you're good at it, then you might as well work your way up the organization and make as much money as you can while you're doing it. Because at the end of the day, this job takes a lot out of you, and you're going to be hopefully going to be retired longer than you've worked, which usually is not the case. But you might as well make as much money as you can while you're doing it. But again, it's not the only reason. It is any reason. It's part of the metric or the amalgamation that makes why did I study, and all those things are different at different times. When I studied for captain, to be honest with you, I was a lieutenant, station two, never expected to be a lieutenant. You know, I'm still living off that. I never expected to be a firefighter at that point. So when I took my captain's test, part of the reason that I feel like I did so well on it, because I had no stress. I was like, if I stay a lieutenant for the rest of my career, I am all set. Like, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. Not that it didn't matter to me. I wanted to do really well. I wanted to come out number one on the list. That was my goal. But I took all that pressure off myself because at the end of the day, if I didn't get promoted, I was still going to be a fire lieutenant. And I was happy with that.
I understand.
Every my motivation has been different every time during promotion, and they're all the same thing. I've always felt like I've got something to add. As I get to this point in my career, it's people ask me all the time, like, when are you going to retire? And my honest answer or my joking answer is when I stop having fun. Like, when I stop having fun, I'm going to retire. And that's certainly true. Because the minute I stop having fun, then it becomes work. It's never been work a day in my life. Been good days and bad days, but it's never been work. But I also feel like when I feel like I don't have anything more to offer, and I feel like I'm still moving the ball forward, I feel like I'm still offering something to the organization that's improving it. And when that stops, then it's time for me to step aside. And I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I just don't know where that is right now, because I'm certainly as time has gone on, it gets some days it gets harder than others, and that's but. But it's still the best. I mean, for me, it's still the best job in the world, and we're blessed to be able to do it every day. And no matter how grumpy I get at any given time, I'd rather do this for free than do something else for $1 million. I mean, it really would.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. And I definitely understand your standpoint on it. And like I was saying earlier, I mean, we all have to provide for our families. That's 100% given. And I understand with promotion and rank comes money. But
Right.
when you have individuals that take the position and all they see is the dollar, and they're not adding any value to their promotion of, hey, as captain, I can affect this change. I can at least affect the four or three people that I work with. When you're not doing anything positively to contribute on that aspect, that's where I have the problem.
100%, 100%. I agree with you 100%. If money is your biggest motivating factor or your sole motivating factor, then that's a problem. I would agree with you 100% about that. I guess what I was just trying to say is that if we're going to be honest with ourselves, it's part of the equation.
Of course.
But yeah, no, you should be able, Chief Salka says all the time, you're not just there to ring the bell and blow the siren. There's responsibility. And if you're not willing to accept that responsibility, and we've certainly all seen our share of fire officers that aren't, that come in and coast or don't set the tempo, then that's a problem. That's 100% a problem. And that's up for, the administration is to promote those guys. And I'm blessed that, my system, I get a pick. So our process is established by the union contract. But then we develop a list, and then the chief gets to pick out of the top four. And we're a small organization, there's only 40 of us. So we all know who everybody is. So it's you're able to, I'm able to with that criteria to pick who I believe. And obviously I talk to my deputy, I talk to my officers, so it's not just my decision, but I get to pick who I think is going to have the best impact on the organization. And sometimes that person may be the qualities that we're looking for may be different based on when that person's getting promoted or where they're going to go, what shift they're going to end up on, whatever. If they're going to go, may take a little bit of a weaker candidate experience-wise, if they're going to go with a strong captain, or, there's just so much that goes into it, but we're blessed that we have that ability. So you can seek out the people you're talking about. They're solely motivated by one, let's not even say it's money, but by one thing, because it should be, in my mind, multiple things. You're getting promoted for multiple reasons. And there's a whole bunch that goes into that. And if you're so driven by one thing, whatever that may be, because you want to wear the right shirt, because you want to have your own bunk room, because you want to have, and I heard that yesterday in the internet, so I don't even know where that came from. But then that's a problem, because you should be ultimately for the greater good, ultimately make the organization better, should be your baseline reason. And then everything else piles on top of that.
Okay, perfect, perfect. My next question for you, as fire chief, how do you feel about outside training? I think I know what your answer is going to be, but I just want to hear your opinion, and I want others to hear your opinion on outside
So
training.
obviously, I'm a fan of these conferences and getting people into these conferences. The Chiefs Association in Barnstable County, it's actually Cape and Islands now. The islands, which are actually their own counties, which whatever, it's Massachusetts, but we bring outside speakers in twice a year. We're actually trying to increase that to potentially four times a year. Like we just had Chief Lube up here. We're going to bring some others. We brought a whole range of people up here. Chief Bob Moran, originally he's the chief in Brewster now, but he's from Englewood, New Jersey originally. Has a bunch of contacts, as I do, as I've been blessed to kind of pick up some. So maybe we'll pick up some great speakers and bring them out here. There's no amount of value that you can put on that. Those outside people's experiences, and everybody gets something different. You have to sometimes be a little bit broad-minded and be able to translate, I guess, is the word I would use, or interpolate that person's experience into your environment. So, like we had Anthony Avila out here one time, and he was talking about, and this isn't a shot at him at all, but talking about fires in three-story wood frame buildings or whatever that were common to the area that he was in. And some of my guys came back afterwards and were like, yeah, he's not really from around here. He doesn't really know the kind of stuff that we do. And then other guys were like, oh, no, it was great. I mean, yeah, we don't have three-story wood frame buildings, but I understood, like his tact. So you have to be able to make that translation in your head. But anyway, so going sideways, outside training, invaluable. Can't stress on enough. The deputy before me really kind of solidly established a foundation of overtime money available for outside training, so that we could encourage our guys. Because at the end of the day, it's nice to be able to want to go to classes, and I have nothing but respect for these people that take the time and the effort and the money to go to all these seminars out of their own pocket. It's phenomenal. But the reality of the world is we all have families. We all have wives. Wives expect us to make money for them and not to be gone for 8 hours a day for free. And so we've been able, and fire service may be one of the only organizations in the world that embraces training for free. And I'm not saying you need to get paid for every hour of training you do. I certainly didn't in the early part of my career, and we were blessed. I got paid for more than I didn't get paid for, but sometimes you had to. Yeah, take it on the chin. Our original training program used to be hour for hour. Town would pay you for an hour, you gave them an hour for free. So we modified that. So now it's the point where last year we had essentially 16 hours of outside training paid for it overtime. This year we've moved it up to 32. So to encourage these people to our people to go out and train. And Mass Fire Academy puts on a bunch of classes. I'm not always a huge fan of, and this is again not a disrespect for anybody, but of the Fire Academy classes. I feel like you get more value sometimes out of some of these smaller conferences, which is more of a hands-on, boots on the ground level of training. But there's value in all training, and we certainly encourage our people to do it as much and often as possible. And then the other thing we budget for is full department training. With the loss of our local fire academy, we used to have a burn building. We now don't have that. We have some mobile props that we can, that whatever the shadow of what that fire academy used to be, makes available to us. But we're looking at trying to figure out how to get a better live fire training program going, but we still budget for it, and we just use that training other ways. We get a lot of our area with we talked about earlier about what the housing market's like. People are buying houses here for $1 million and then tearing them down and building a brand new house where the house is. It's insane. But we get a great training opportunity. We have some great relationships with the contractors. And as long as the window of demolition and rebuild works for our schedule and their schedule, they'll make the house available to us for a couple, 3, 4 days or a week. And we can go in and do some, not necessarily live fire, but we can do a bunch of other training in those buildings. And that's invaluable, putting people in real buildings. I have a pet project that I've been working on, and I've been dragging my feet on it way too long, of trying to get some type of container building built out behind the station so that we have the ability to do small live fire training in-house. I'm still working on trying to get that done. So yeah, no, I 100% am a fan, and we will approve. We have a bunch of people to go to the Heavy Rescue Conference in Syracuse, and they found it, kind of found it on their own. I know Augie Matt, I've known him for a while, and actually was blessed to teach with some of his guys in Harrisburg. I didn't teach with him, but we were at the same conference teaching together. And Augie's a great guy. One of our guys found the conference kind of zone through Instagram and wanted to go. And then, that's great. Like when you get that groundswell, like one guy went and then talked to a buddy on the shift, and then two of them were going, and then three of them were going. And then all of a sudden we had like six people going out to the conference, and great experience. So they went out again the following year. One of my captains and another firefighter were down in North Carolina for training days. And that same captain signed up for Alexandria. So there are guys that are seeking outside stuff and bringing in those outside instructors. So we just keep trying to make more and more stuff available. But yeah, I probably my biggest failure as a company officer when I look back at the things I did is I was not good at coming up with shift level drills or company drills. I struggled with that. Didn't train anywhere near as much as I could have or should have as a company officer. So when I made deputy and then, now as chief, have done everything, tried to do everything in my power to support the officers to make that easier for them, because it's so important. It's so important. And it's hard when, I'm listening. They've been out, shift started at 8 o'clock this morning. They're on their ninth, their seventh or eighth call right now. So it's
Jeez.
hard when you're that busy to get a
Right.
lot of training done on duty,
Right.
which is why we encourage the training off duty or outside training and everything else so that they can train. So.
Okay. No, I love it. And I figured it was going to go that route because you partake in these conferences. So, awesome. In your opinion, what do you think the fire service could What do you think the fire service is doing good on, and what do you think that they can improve on when it comes to recruitment and retention?
So I think that going back to like we talked about the pool of candidates available. So we do high school interns.
Okay.
We actually have a college intern coming in the summer. We did one a couple of years ago, which was funny because he came in as a college intern with a and he was in a like an emergency management type program, whatever. We ended up having he built out our pre-plan system for us. And then went to work for like an insurance company doing like risk assessment and everything else. And last time I talked to him, he was like in Cary, North Carolina, applying for a full-time job and as a firefighter and wanted to use me for a reference. The college intern we have coming in the summer is going to, again, he's a both a criminal justice and a fire science degree. Doesn't know which direction he wants to go. We're going to use him to build out our incident action plans for active shooter for different buildings. We're going to have established plans for all our schools. So he's going to do that. Plus, we'll give him an indoctrination into the fire service, let him ride the trucks and give him some training and do everything else. I think any opportunity we have to get people early and train them or give them experience is critical in increasing our recruitment and retention. Like we need to start them young kind of thing. I think that it went by the wayside a little bit. And I think that the fire service has to overcome kind of this closed shop mentality of like, well, we know what we do and we don't need to tell anybody what we do. Now I think we need to take every opportunity to celebrate our successes, our failures, to be transparent with the community, to educate the community. And we've never had better tools to do that. Social media right now, if your community doesn't know what your fire department's doing, shame on you. There's no excuse because you have an ability to educate your community every single day, even with what you think are the most mundane things, but they're not to them. They are to us, but they're not to them. So we started our Facebook page, I think probably 2015, 20, right around the time I became deputy. And we are constantly putting stuff out there. And I hear all the time as chief feedback from the community about, y'all really appreciate you keeping us up to date. Really appreciate it. And again, it's silly things sometimes that you put out there that, may not seem that important to us, but the citizens who ultimately are paying for your fire department don't know about it, and you let them know about it, and it's a great opportunity to educate them, and I think we'll also go a long way towards encouraging people. We have a technical school, the tech schools on the Cape, there's two regional tech schools, so one of them's in Harwich, and we started, the Chiefs Association started 2 or 3 years ago, a fire science program in the tech school with the goal of trying to build it out so that they could get firefighter 1, 2 and their EMT before they graduated. So we could start developing people early. And if you think about the tech school is like a great environment because they're learning a trade and you give them some firefighter training, and those are our potential future firefighters, right? That are going to, you know, they're going to be plumbers, carpenters, electricians on the side. Number one, those are the kind of people we want doing the job because they have mechanical skills and they understand buildings and things like that. But also, you know, if you look at it from another aspect, they're the people that are going to be our firefighters and then run their business on the side or work for somebody on the side, you know, doing carpentry or whatever, because the schedule allows for that. So I think we need to just continue to advocate for, to educate, to make people aware of what we do. You know, Citizens Fire Academies are another great one. Our problem, and we'll say our problem, the demographic that takes our Citizen Fire Academy tends to be the older registered voter versus the young student.
Right.
There's no problem with that, because to me, it's still an opportunity to educate those people, and that's a great opportunity. But, you know, trying to get into the schools, trying to get these high school interns. We had a high school intern. Kid was awesome. Probably the best success story of an intern that I would ever come up with, because he didn't want to become a firefighter after he did his internship. He learned so much. I watched Dave to do a PowerPoint presentation. I watched his PowerPoint presentation, and he learned so much from our people. Like, one of the biggest things he learned, like, never be that guy. Like, never be the guy that makes the mission fail. Like, he learned that. That was a slide in his PowerPoint. Like, whatever you do, don't be that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He went on one ambulance call with the shift and was in the back of the ambulance. The person, you know, fell, broke their arm, something. I don't know what the call was. It doesn't matter. Walked out of that ambulance call and was like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to, not that he didn't want to finish the internship, but I don't want to do this. This is not a career for me. He said, I'm not comfortable seeing people in pain. And to me, that's the bigger success, because we took somebody that may have spent a lot of time and effort and energy trying to become a firefighter and then felt trapped once they got there because they spent so much time and energy trying to do it. And we've all worked with those people. You work with people that spend 30 years doing a job that they're miserable doing because they can't figure a way out of it because they spent so much time getting into it. So to me, the fact that he figured out that he didn't want to do it when he was 17 years old in high school is a bigger success than the 2 or 3 people we've had that have come out. They've gone to Southern Maine Community College that has a fire science program with a live-in student opportunity and are flourishing up there now as firefighters in career departments, or have come back as firefighters. So those are successes too. They're great. But to me, the failure was the bigger success, if that makes sense.
No, definitely. Definitely does. And unfortunately, we have individuals that I like to call, they're hiding in the shadows of their firefighters, but deep down inside, they're not comfortable doing it, and they continue to do it because they haven't been put to that test.
100%. 100%. And, we all know the nicknames that they get called and everything else, and every department has them. And, you know, it's interesting to go down a rabbit hole a little bit here. You know, we talk about when transitional attack first came out, and I was not, I was pretty vocal against it, and not that I'm vocal against it. It has a place. And I don't think it's transitional attack. I think it's whatever we used to do, hit it from the yard, you know, not hit from the yard, but like a, you know, blitz attack or whatever it was, but not going to go down that road. But one of the things that I felt like we were doing as a fire service is making it comfortable for people who are uncomfortable doing the job. Like, I felt like we were looking for ways to make the job, for lack of a better word, easier for those people. And those people, like, you know, I think you have to be honest that not everybody has had great experience in the fire service. People work for bad bosses. Mm-hmm. They've worked for bad departments. And their experience may have created training scars for them that made them uncomfortable. And then now they get promoted because they're the most qualified, least qualified person that on the list, and they get promoted. And now they're trying to, now they have to, now they're going to do the real job. It's harder to hide once you're the boss. And they're trying to make, so I feel like there's some people that latched on to things like transitional tech because it was a way to do the job easier, safer, for them based on whatever their experience was. Now, some people were just never going to be comfortable doing the job, but some people probably had or may have had a bad experience that made them uncomfortable and were never given the opportunity to kind of overcome that. So I think that that's, something we need to, when you look at what everybody's experience is, not everybody's experience is the same, and not everybody worked for rock stars growing up, and some people's experience was based on, old school people that did things way differently, and that stuff doesn't work in the environment we're in now, but that's what they know. So it's, it's a funny little dynamic there. But so to me, like the failure is, to your point, figuring out that, hey, this isn't for me, before you're so invested in it that you don't have any other choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Last topic. I want to hit on leadership, whether it's company officers or chief officers. And with you being a firefighter who's rose through the ranks, what does leadership mean to you?
Wow, that's probably gonna be the hardest question. So, well, it's kind of like one of those, like, the old joke about, like, what is pornography? I don't know, but I'll tell you when I see it. Like, so leadership to me is, I struggle with, I actually started writing this article, and I got so frustrated I couldn't finish writing it. It's still half written on my phone. But, like, every day you open Facebook, you open Instagram, you open LinkedIn, anything, and there's somebody telling you all the traits you need to be a good leader. The 15 traits of a great leader. Every leader must have these qualities. Every leader, and my experience with leadership has been that you have to be comfortable in your own skin with the skills that you have, and then you have to make sure that you put people around you that have the skills that you don't have. So not all leaders are General Patton, and thank God. I mean, he was great at some things, but the world would have been a mess if it was, the army would have been a mess if there wasn't. Like, yeah, he's the guy you want at leading the attack, but you don't want him the other 365 days of the year because he was a mess, when he dealt with the soldiers in some, not in every case, but in some cases, and it may not be a great example. But so I feel like we get sold this, and I'm gonna call it a bill of goods. We get sold this bill of goods of, you have to have these 15 qualities if you're gonna be a good leader. And it's just not true because it's unattainable. I'm not going to have the charisma that some people have. My deputy is much more of a people person than I am, and it's not that I'm not a people person. He's just better at it than I am. I recognize that. Confrontation is not my big thing. I struggle with it. I live on my emotions. I'm a huge emotion-driven person, which sucks. You're trying to stay detached from something, right? When you're trying to, when it's just business. It isn't for me. It's personal for me. Even though it's not personal, it becomes personal. So, I think what's important as a leader is that you're honest, and that you are empathetic, and that you support the organization. Like those things. If I had to say, like, are the three things. Honesty, integrity—you can flip-flop them. To me, they're basically the same thing because you can't have integrity without honesty. You need to be empathetic. You need to understand the other person's point of view, and then you need to support the organization. And supporting the organization is supporting the chief, supporting the policy, supporting the directive, supporting your people. It's a whole bunch of things. And so those are kind of broad umbrellas that I would put under, but that's what leadership means to me. We fall apart when we start putting ourselves before the organization. When you, as an officer, when you, as a chief, when you decide that you know better than the organization, so you're gonna not follow this policy because you wanna do it your way, everybody underneath you, we say it all the time, and I say it in joking, and I probably shouldn't, but the children are watching. Everybody else sees how you behave and knows what is acceptable. Like I said, it's just we live in a small organization. There's no secrets in a 40-man department. There's no secrets, 40-person department, excuse me. There's absolutely no secrets. Everybody knows who everybody is. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what buttons to push. Everybody knows what you do, what you don't do. They know what you say. They know how you feel about this person, how you feel about that person. There are very few secrets. So if you're not following policy, how can you expect your people to follow policy? It's a double standard, right?
Right.
The do as I say, not as I do doesn't work. Just like because I said so, it doesn't work when your father told you. Like, yeah, I know, Dad, you're going to kick my ass because I'm not. But because I said so, it doesn't work. So I think that's why those things are important to me. You got to have integrity, which means you're going to do the right thing. You have to be empathetic. You have to be able to understand what's going on with your people and listen to your people. But you have to support the organization, whatever that is, even if you don't agree with it. My chief before when I was deputy, he and I would go into his office, close the door, and go toe to toe over things in his office.
Okay.
I would lose 90% of the time, and I would come out of that office and I would support whatever we were going to do as a department as if it was my own ideas. And that is not always easy to do. Because when you don't agree with something to the point where you're willing to go argue about it, and then you have to come out. But I never went to the people and said, hey, the chief wants to do this. Because that's a cop-out. Now that's just me saying, yeah, it's over here. He wants to do that.
Uh-huh.
I would come out and say, this is what we're going to do. Or this is what the policy is. And you have to support that. And you take a lot of slings and arrows over that because you do it. But that's your job. That was my job as a deputy. Right? I would say to him all the time, I disagree with you till the end, but I will take a bullet for you. I will take every bullet for you because that's my job as a deputy, is to insulate, not insulate you from that, but to support your ideas as my own, to support your ideas as the department's going forward. And so I think that that's where that's hard. And I'm not saying I was perfect at it. Certainly wasn't. And a one-on-one conversation with somebody is different than talking to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
But I might say, you might have a conversation with a captain where he's like, Jesus, what's the old man thinking? And you'd be like, yeah, listen, this is what we're going to do. And I hear you, but this is what we're going to do. But again, you being able to listen to people that didn't agree, understand their feedback, and still be able to say, but this is what we're going to do. And it certainly not going through COVID. COVID was probably the most difficult time in my career. I know I've talked to a lot of chief officers, said the same thing, because there was so much conflicting information out there. I'm trying to keep the political aspect out of it. Just the what was coming out, we were being mandated to do things that people just vehemently disagreed with, and trying to manage all of that and keep the firehouse running as a firehouse was arguably one of the most difficult things in my career, and probably took years off my life and certainly took years off my career because of what we went through. But that's a case where it's not about what I think or what I feel. And I would tell people all the time, you're never going to know how I feel about COVID personally. You're never going to know how I feel. But I'm going to tell you is that we all answer to somebody and we all have rules to follow, and we're going to follow the rules because
right.
I don't have a choice. So if I don't have a choice, you don't have a choice.
Right. Okay. To take it back just a little bit.
Sure.
If the example that you mentioned of your chief while you were deputy would go toe to toe, on things that you didn't agree with, at what point though, in your opinion, do you think if you were the chief and I was you and I didn't agree with your decision, like at what point do you just stop like swallowing that pride and just agreeing with it? You know what I mean? Because that's very hard to do.
So I guess the thing is that I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know that I ever did.
Okay.
I don't know that I ever did.
Okay.
Because I think that at the end of the day, he's still the chief.
Right.
So unless he's talking about something, unless the chief is talking about, and it didn't happen all that often with my chief and I. So there were definitely things, and like I'm sure my deputy, there are definitely things that he
right.
wanted done that I, was off the reservation about. And I'm sure I pissed him off the other way just as well. So, it's fine. But I'm not sure that I ever did. I'm not sure I ever got to a point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. Because I
Okay.
think when you get to that point, you need to walk away. Like, you need to be done. So you need to, I think that's the one thing you need to accept is that, like, this is how we're going to do it. You go and you make your case. You try and make your case in a reasonable, thought-out manner. But like everything, at some point, he has to make a decision. And hopefully he's open-minded enough to have listened to what you've said. And once he does, if he decides to do something opposite of what you feel, I think you just have to accept that and move on. You have to take this, we talked earlier about ego. You have to take your ego. You can't be so close to your ego with your decision that him not agreeing with your decision goes against your ego. Like, you have to be able to separate those two and be like, hey, this is what I see, Chief. You see this, argue about it. Come to a conclusion. Nope, you're not going to change. Okay, let's go forward. Let's go forward. And there were days when we may not have talked for a couple of days after those conversations. Didn't mean that I didn't go out and support what he told me we were going to do, but my relationship with him was a little frosty until we both got over it and went back to calling each other names and drinking coffee. I mean, it's the nature of the thing, but I don't know that you ever can. I don't know that you can ever come to that point unless it's a life safety issue or something like that, where you ever are like, no, Chief, I don't care what you say. I will never be on board with what you're doing. I can't swallow this. I can't go out and advocate for it as my own. This is your problem. Because the minute you do that, the relationship, the trust that the two of you have is gone. It's gone. And you may feel strongly enough to break that. I get it. And I understand the question you're asking me. You may feel strongly enough about that issue where you have to break that trust, but understand once you break that trust, it's broken. And to me, the only option out is that you have to leave, or he has to leave, or somebody's there's got to
Somebody's
be a
gotta,
thing. Yeah, you've broken. If the issue is that big that you're willing to stand in the door and say, I will never in my life support what you're doing as a decision, then something's got to give. And I'm familiar with the chief and deputy that are going through that right now, where the deputy basically was like, either he goes or I go. And it's not local, it's cross country, but somebody I'm friends with. And what do you do in that situation? Well, chief's not going, so guess what? Deputy's going.
No, I mean I think that's one of the hardest things that we have going on, hardest things to do in the fire services, listening to, like, I may not agree on how others do things, but I think instead of just immediately going, oh, you don't see my viewpoints, you don't understand it, I'm shutting you down, I don't want to talk to you ever, like, we need to at least here, I think that that's the biggest problem is nobody wants to take the time to hear each other's side anymore. It's either you're with me or you're not, and that's it.
And the other side of the coin, that goes with this, Danny, is like, you and I may not agree on something. That doesn't affect my relationship with you. I don't agree with people on a lot of things. I guess depending on what the issue is, we all have those issues, right? That not agreeing about the color of fire trucks is different than not agreeing about whether or not we're going to do primary searches. Those are like different levels of not agreeing on things. But I could not agree with you on 100% of the things in the fire service. I'm not going to hold that against you as a person. You're still you, I'm still me. We can have a difference of opinion and still be friends and still get along with each other. That, and I think I had a captain a long time ago that told me, he's like, fire service is just a microcosm of society. Whatever society does as a whole, the fire service does the same thing. It's no different. And I think if you look at the world we live in right now, and the political world that we live in, and just the total inability of anybody to listen to anybody and have a reasonable conversation without flaming out and going nuclear, I think that that's where we're at in the fire service, right? It's the same thing.
Absolutely.
Two guys can't sit around the kitchen table and have a disagreement about how to stretch a hose line without one guy calling the other guy a jerk, and it go like, really? There's a million different ways to do this job, and I don't know that they're right. I know it works for me. And as the chief, I get the little bit say, well, if it works for me, then that's going to work for the department. We talked about this with one of my captains. I said, there's a bunch of different ways to force a door. Well, let's come up with the Harwich way. Let's come up with the one that we think works the best and train everybody on that. Now, should you have a couple other tricks up your sleeve? Absolutely. But instead of, you know, it kind of equates to like Common Core math. Instead of teaching everybody every single different way so that they have a broad knowledge but little skill, let's hone them down so that they have really good skill in one way. Make sure that they have the adaptability to alter if they hit that roadblock. And not really about the other 75 different ways that they haven't been taught. You know, I think that that's important. Like, you think you need to set that standard. You need to say, hey, this is how we're going to, you know, we adopted nozzle forward, a lot of the stuff from nozzle forward a few years back. But we adopted it for our small animals. We left our two and a halves as flat load. They come off the rear, they're pre-connected, but they come off the rear. And it was just in talking to the people that did the nozzle forward, they're like, this makes more sense for us. So, okay, fine. So you don't have to do everything 100 way, but let's come up with a standard so we're all doing it at least the same way.
Right.
You know, we joke, four separate fire departments, three separate fire departments. You know, that's been the bane of my existence since I've been a firefighter. Like, I hated that. I've been, you know, I love the idea of riding positions and policy-driven assignments. And so to me, it was like the less I have to think. I would tell my guys when I was a captain, like, you right here, you do this, and I don't have to think about that because I got other things to think about, and I'm not smart enough to think about what I need to do, what I need to figure out, and then what you need to do. So you know you need to do this, and if I need to change that, I'll tell you. You know, we'll call an audible. But I, you know, I think that that's where the trying to hone everybody in and just come up with, this is how we're going to do it. Especially in our department, and I know that we're not a lot different than anybody else, but for me, for an our department, where if you're in headquarters right now with four people, you're either going on the engine, the truck, or the ambulance, depending on what the call is. So you either need to be a good engine man, a good truckman, or, you know, or on the ambulance. And that changes 15 times during the day based on what call volume is. So what we already need to know, like, it's not like you're assigned to a truck company and you're only doing truck things, so you can really hone in on those things. No, you're assigned to a shift and you're doing engine things, ladder things, ambulance things. You need to be good at all of them. So the less things that we teach or the more that we focus the skill set in, they're going to be better at one particular thing on that. And it may not be the best way to do it, but it works. It's our way to do it, and it works. And we practice it, and it works well for us. So that's, you know, kind of where I would like to get. I will tell you that one of the most humbling things that I figured out being the fire chief is you have the ability to make any change you want, and you still can't make that change. It's funny how it, because you still have to, you know, like, you have to win over the masses. You have to get buy-in. You have to, so just, you know, all the people are like, I don't know why the chief doesn't do this, right? It's just not that easy. It's not that easy. You're like, I want this to happen, because you're dealing with people, and people have their own thoughts and ideas about how that should happen.
Definitely. No, you're definitely 100% right. And I love how you put it, because, you know, you stated we're going to do things the Harwich way, and to others, they might not, you know, look at that as correct, but you do what's best for your organization. You know, if you have to run a quint, you run a quint. If you run a true truck, you run a true truck. But, you know, you have individuals out there, man, you know, they will bat. Oh, why are you guys using that ladder truck as an engine? Because we have to do that. It's the way it works for us. And if we can get everybody on board to seeing, hey, departments do what works for them, I think we would have a lot less bickering and a lot of less friction going on.
Yeah, Bill Carey's, you know, he's been saying it for a long time. And he's, you know, he's funny because, we're pretty similar in thought process. But he says it all the time. It's like, you do you. You know, you do you. And it's not a dismissive thing. It's like, if that's what works for your organization, then do it. If you want, but do it well. Mm-hmm. Now, unless you're doing something completely moronic, and there are those things. So, you know, you have to temper that a little bit. But
right.
What you're doing is, you know, quints have their place in the fire service. I know there's people that are screaming, or that will scream when they hear that. No, I don't necessarily love the quint concept. For us, it made sense. What happened with us was we had an engine that needed to be replaced, and we had a ladder that needed to be replaced in 2 years. The budget was tight when we were supposed to replace the engine. So what we did to the town is we said, we'll push the engine off a year, we'll move the truck up a year, and we'll get rid of two trucks and buy one, and we'll buy a Quint. A little bit less capability for us because we lost the fourth engine, but save the town $1 million in the process when we costed the whole thing out. Town embraced it. We probably wouldn't have gotten at that time frame the reading of tea leaves. We probably weren't going to be able to replace the truck if we had to replace it with a ladder truck in 2 years. The budget was not there to support that. So we went through this. It happened during COVID. It got delayed a year, whole nine yards. So we got the Quint. As a fire chief, I understand the Quint's concept. I understand why it doesn't work. It's not going to be able to do both companies. You know, the duties of both companies well. It's not. Just simple fact, especially if you don't staff it with 12 people. You know, it's not going to happen. So so we run it as a dedicated truck company unless the headquarters engine company is out of service. And then it runs as both. If it runs as a Quint, it's running as an engine first. So we're going to position it like an engine. And if it can't do truck work, we're having two more trucks coming in on the automatic aid, and one of them is going to pick up the slack.
Okay.
And that's just the only problem is it's a 40-foot engine company. It's a big engine company, and that creates some problems for us, which is why we went to the mini pumper for those small routine calls, type stuff. So but again, to your point, if it works, if it's stupid and it works, right? So just because you don't understand it, well, come walk in my shoes and I'll explain it to you. And I get beat up. The guys that I teach with all the time, we have a chat group, and they kill me every single day about the Quint, just busting my chops, which is fine. If I had no choice, I'd have bought a straight stick and we would add fourth engine and that'd been fine. That wasn't the world we lived in at the time. So we made decisions based on that. And I have no regrets for it. It's the truck we bought is functional. Probably the biggest weakness it has is it's got side stack ladders. And for the shorter people in the department, trying to get the ladders off the side stack and in the jacks are thrown is a problem. Mm-hmm. There's no real easy way to overcome that. And I didn't want to lose hose bed to having a rear ladder tunnel, because then if you're using it as the hose bed, becomes a nightmare to try and load and unload and everything else. So everything's a compromise. And you just, as long as you kind of put some thought into it and you're willing to adapt and listen to people, and then, it'll all work out. And, it's not going to be the same for everybody, but that's where it comes back to what Bill says. You do you. If that works for you, great. I'm not going to argue about why you do what you do. I'm going to ask you questions to understand it. That's a piece of advice I was ever given. It was in my chief fire officer's class. Was a guy who said, seek first to understand. It's a Japanese proverb. Seek first to understand. And I told them when I made chief, I told it to my officers, the first officers meeting. I'm like, I'm going to ask you why. I'm not questioning you. I'm trying to understand. And there's a difference in that. When I ask you, why did you do this? It's not me saying, why did you do that? It's me saying, hey, what were you thinking? I'm trying to understand. And I may, there may be some dialogue that goes back and forth from that, good and bad. And that's fine. That's how we learn. That's how we grow.
Definitely. Love it. Love it, Chief. Lots of little nuggets and gems being dropped on there. And the best part about it is you keep it authentic. Everything that you say is real. Taking your class at Carolina Fire Days, you state what your mission priorities are. And not a lot of chiefs do that. Not a lot of chiefs have a set standard, a set mission. And to be honest, I don't know a lot of fire chiefs that go to fire conferences. I mean, there are some out there. I just don't know many of them. So, but you are one of them. So I just have to say thank you for coming on and talking shop. But before we leave, I want to ask you, how many calls does your department run? Because you already said they shift change was 8 and they were on their 7th call. So what do you guys average annually?
So we do about right around 5,000. We were on a trajectory right before COVID, not to go back to COVID, but right before COVID, we were going to blow 5,000 out of the water. And then with COVID, we actually were like the anomaly from, we did less runs after, once COVID hit and we hit the lockdown, we slowed way down. We didn't, people didn't call the fire department. They didn't want anybody in their house, so it was, and then we never really kind of, I hate to say recovered from that, but we just kind of plateaued. So between 4,800 and 5,000 is kind of where we hit. We're not the busiest by any stretch around us, but we're not the slowest. We tend to do like days, and we'll do days like today where they'll pile on 5 or 6 calls in, in 3 hours, and then we won't do anything for 24 hours. We're definitely the, and it seems like that happens a lot around here. Like, it's like the first person calls 911 and everybody else thinks it's a good idea, something, they all do it afterwards. So, you get just, we'll have these pile-ons. We'll have all four ambulances on the road and two mutual aid trucks in it and be like, what happened? Like,
Right.
what just happened that this happened? But it's, so it's, like I said, we're not the busiest, we're not the biggest. And, I'm always humbled by the fact, and I talked about it at training days, is that, for me, as not even as a fire chief, because my voice started a long time ago. I started writing articles when I was a lieutenant. To have any kind of national voice, and I know social media gives everybody a national voice to some degree, but and to have any kind of people buy into or listen to what I say and think it has value is super humbling for me, because I'll start, as I started on training, is I am a small town fire chief from a very small town in New England. I know who I am, where I grew up. We do way more ambulance calls than we do anything else. We're blessed that we, because of where we're located, we get to go to a lot of fires, mutual aid. So we do a little bit more work than we would do if we weren't where we were, if we didn't live on a peninsula and so on and so forth. But I'm really, I try to stay super grounded to where I came from and who I am. So for me, it's super humbled, to even just to be on this podcast, to do these podcasts, to think that anybody's interested at all in what I might have to say. It's super, super humbling. So I appreciate the opportunity. Definitely enjoy talking with you in Carolina, and enjoy what you're doing and the information you're putting out. So it's definitely been a privilege.
Yes, sir. No, thank you. Thank you very much. This is great. Like I said, I love, I don't get many fire chiefs coming on. I'm hopefully starting to turn that a little bit because I want to hear what fire chiefs have to say. I want to hear fire chiefs promote and let the men and women of their organization know that they care and they matter. So thank you for coming on.
Happy to do it. Very happy to do
Yes, sir. Thank you. You have the rest of your good day.
it. All right, you too.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.